Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else, a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities around the world. I'm Ray Lang, Associate Professor of Computer Science at Xavier University of Louisiana. And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else. We're certainly privileged to have with us today a leading public intellectual, Professor Noam Chomsky, the American linguist, philosopher, political commentator, and foremost critic of state capitalism, the corporate media, and U.S. foreign policy. He's the author of over 100 books and is a prominent cultural figure. Professor Chomsky is widely recognized for his unfailing willingness to speak truth to power in the promotion of human rights. He's presently Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Good afternoon, Professor Chomsky.
Glad to be with you.
This podcast, the core audience is mostly college faculty. And for the traditional group of students 17 to 22, and more and more, especially places that serve traditionally underserved populations, blacks and minorities, and those usually left out of mix, we see students coming in more and more with a sort of, if you can't beat them, join them, resignation. They recognize what's going on, and they've just like already bought into it because they've just haven't had a lot of good preparation for critical thinking and analytical, you know, perspective. What can faculty do when it's sort of swimming upstream right at the starting gate?
Well, from the way you describe these students, I'm not so sure that they don't have analytic capacities. The way you describe them, they seem to have figured out that the system is stacked in such a way that they don't have many choices, so they therefore conclude, well, we'll just have to adapt to it. But of course, it does require, and I mean, if that's what's happening, that does involve critical thinking. I mean, if they're just kind of absorbing, accepting without thinking, well, of course it doesn't. I think, you know, I don't really have anything profound to say about this. I think every teacher knows you have to, people are naturally inquisitive. Children are naturally inquisitive. That's why they're asking questions all the time. And at every stage of life, people want to understand. And you have to try to, you can set up a curriculum, a program of teaching, which either kind of, to use the old image from the 18th century, pours water into a vessel. That's one approach. Or you can try to pose problems. Let's try to understand this. Here's a problem. Let's try to figure it out. And there's endless numbers of them. I mean, you can ask, you take a look at the contemporary United States, and you see some very dramatic things. There's tens of millions of people who want work. There's an immense amount of work that has to be done. You just drive around any city, and it's falling apart. We don't have enough teachers, nothing. I mean, a huge amount of work to be done. The energy system has to be reconstructed and so on. There's plenty of resources. There's wealth, unbelievable amounts of wealth available in very few pockets. But the system is so rotten that you can't take idle hands, needed work, ample resources, and put them together. So a very simple question, why?
I mean, how why did we get here?
Pardon?
How did we get here?
Yeah. That's the question. But that's the question where you don't just give the answer. You ask students to explore it. What are the reasons why a rich country with advantages that no other country has has a situation like what I just described. You can do it in cases like that. You can do it in the sciences. So, for example, there are efforts at science education which are trying very hard to stimulate critical thinking. One that I just happened to hear about a little while ago is a program in which begins by asking a simple question: how can a mosquito fly in the rain? Well, it turns out that if you look at it, the force of a raindrop on a mosquito, if we were subjected to comparable force, we'd be crushed, flattened out in the ground. So how can a mosquito fly in the rain? Well, as soon as you start to look into that, you get interesting questions of physics, biology, cognition, and so on. And almost anything you look at, you pick it up, you can find exciting, complicated questions that people can explore and try to find answers to. And that's the way to do it. It's been known for a long time. There's no secrets.
What's the pushback against foundations and agencies and state governments even, and at the federal level, against this drive to measure skills and push out, really squeeze out the humanities, where a lot of critical thinking is enabled, and where a lot of students learn to become facile higher order thinkers?
Well, you know, quite typically, institutions, almost of any kind, try to enforce conformity, obedience, and passivity. They don't try to encourage the kind of critical thought and action which will threaten the structure of power and domination in the institution. I mean, that's pretty natural, not hard to explain. And in the case you're talking about, the educational systems are designed to turn people into passive, obedient, conformist individuals who won't ask questions and will simply do what they're told. It's kind of training for the Marine Corps.
It is. So teaching critical thinking really can be viewed as a subversive act in and of itself.
It is. Critical thinking is the last thing that people that those who have some degree of power and authority want. Of course, they say they want critical thinking. And if you look at it, it's kind of interesting. So, for example, you know ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. You know
about
them? Yeah,
yes.
You know about them. So one of their recent programs is to try to get state legislatures to pass legislation which, as they put it, will encourage critical thinking. Sounds nice.
It does.
Take a look at it. What they mean is that if a sixth grade class has a section on, say, climate change, you have to introduce climate change denial so they'll learn critical thinking. I mean, the cynicism of power is really impressive. So if you say, yeah, let's have critical thinking, they'll probably applaud, but they mean it in their way, not your way.
Right, right. You remark that the wealthy and powerful are confounded by the fact that the public is still too committed to scientific rationality.
Yeah, that's the reason for these ALEC programs. Yeah.
What strengthens that commitment, especially in the face of people who come forward with grants to keep the doors open that want something other than that?
Well, the force behind it is obvious enough, and it's not secret. The energy corporations, American Chamber of Commerce, and others are quite open in saying that they are trying to bring people to doubt that either to doubt that climate warming is taking place or else to question whether humans are involved. You read the business press today. As soon as the latest IPCC report came out with very dire warnings, take a look at the Wall Street Journal and Forbes magazine and so on, immediately saying, well, of course, it's all a joke. What was really happening is global cooling, you know, the environment's cooling. They surely don't want people to believe anything and act in ways which will undercut their profit in the next quarter. I mean, in the moral calculus of their form of capitalism, profit in the next quarter completely outweighs the fate of your grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although they'll often say that what they do is to protect future generations.
Well, they say, like Alex says, it's interested in critical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What then is there? How genuine do you think billionaire philanthropists are who really don't take a right wing approach, like the George Soros sort?
I think it varies. You have to look at the person and what they're doing. Maybe they're perfectly serious. Maybe they're doing the right thing. Maybe they're cynical. I don't think there's a general answer.
Mm-hmm. What would it take, do you think, to convince someone who really had a corporatist, capitalist agenda in mind that it's not really in their long-term self-interest?
Well, it depends what capitalist agenda you have in mind. There is a capitalist agenda which says we don't care about long-term interest. We're interested in getting a bigger bonus next week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So for them, there's nothing to say. They're doing the right thing from their point of view.
Right.
For those who care about their grandchildren, or even for those who care about the health of the enterprise that they're managing, then, of course, you can make rational arguments. It's worth noting that there has been a change in corporate culture over the past generation, a couple of generations. They say back in the 1950s, the CEO of a corporation typically was concerned with the long-term health and survival of that corporation. Today, much more likely the CEO of a corporation is concerned with making short-term profits which will raise his salary and bonuses, and if the whole business collapses 10 years from now, it's not my business.
Mm-hmm.
That's a change in corporate culture. It's been discussed. There's literature about it. Striking change in corporate culture.
Are you optimistic?
Well, there, as always, the hope for change, and it's always there, is that people will just have had enough and decide, I'm not going to take it anymore. We're going to change the society, which can be done. You know, these are fragile systems. They can be changed.
Well, seems the more out of balance a society gets, the less stable it's liable to be. But, of course, when the collapse comes, there's no way to tell which way it'll fall.
Absolutely. But these are all matters that depend on human will and choice. You have to decide which way you want to press developments. And there's no way of predicting. Never has been.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else can you offer college faculty as by way of encouragement to take on the risks? Because there are risks to being too innovative in the classroom.
Yeah, risk is you lose your job, for one thing.
I mean, that's the most obvious.
Yeah, but others, you know, I was just talking to a graduate student who handed in his doctoral dissertation in literature. It was a very good dissertation, but he was pretty critical of prevailing doctrines, post-structuralist doctrines. And, the faculty didn't like it. They told him, well, you could pass the dissertation, but you're never going to get a job because you can't question these things. Well, you know, that's those factors are always there. But I, like always, you have to ask yourself, what are my values? How much do I value being able to look into the mirror and being proud or satisfied of what I see? And how much do I value things that do make sense, like putting food on the table for my children? And those things sometimes come into conflict. Neither I nor anyone else can give advice about that. Those are dilemmas that each of us has to face.
Exactly. Any thoughts or remarks on the Common Core?
You know, I don't particularly love it. I don't think there's a Common Core that everyone has to know. But it can be, I think it can be used in a creative and constructive fashion by a dedicated and committed teacher.
And now we're seeing some states that adopted it now are backing away from it.
Well, they're backing away for all kinds of reasons, like many of the right-wing legislators and governors are now taking the position that, you know, this is overreaching by the federal government. And it's kind of like the mentality of this rancher out in Nevada who wants to graze his cattle on federal land. What do the feds have to tell me? But maybe there's, you know, I don't think it's either good or bad in itself, frankly. I think it can be used harmfully just to sort of force kids to study particular things that they have no particular interest in because some authority said that's what you got to know. That would be harmful. On the other hand, if you can take the elements of the Common Core and think about them and ask why they're important and what can I learn from them and how can it help me become a creative individual, which you can do, say, with works of great literature, well, then it can be positive, whether it's selected by the federal government or by the local school board.
Well, that's very helpful, actually. It says it's not really necessary to take sides for or against the Common Core. It depends on how it's implemented.
On what you can do with it. And there are plenty of options. Like a lot of the material in the Common Core is very much worth learning and understanding.
Well, Professor Chomsky, that's about all the time we have, and I don't want to take up any more of yours. Let me thank you very much again. This has been a personal privilege as well. Thank you for your time.
Very glad to have a chance to talk to you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else. For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu. That's cat.xula.edu. Until next time, this is Ray Lang.